You're listening to Early Doors Football Podcast with host Mark Roach and co-hosts Dylan Kerr, Tom Watt and Sherelle Casal, a For The Now media production.
Welcome to episode 12 of the Early Doors Football Podcast. As usual, we've got some great guests, including Peter Shilton talking about his gambling addiction. But before that, it's time for
Highlight of the Week.
Still with Elise. Now Zaha, this surely to wrap it up. Wanted one touch too many. Gallagher, who finishes in style, and that surely has finished off Manchester City.
As the ball falls to his feet, does he have the composure, the ability to finish? You better believe he does.
And courtesy of Sky Sports, that was
Highlight of the Week.
And now I'm delighted to introduce the England legend Peter Shilton OBE and his wife Steph. How are you both?
Very well, thanks, Mark.
And you've very kindly agreed to join us to talk about your 45-year gambling addiction, Peter, and the new book that you've written together, Saved. So I'd like to start, if I can, by asking you, Peter, when did you first realise that you had a gambling problem?
I think when I met Steph, you know, I think it was a way of life, or it became a way of life to me. It started out just a few bets. I mean, mine was basically horse racing. I loved horse racing. I owned racehorses. I loved the atmosphere, etc. But on the back of that was the gambling. And then it accelerated in the 80s and 90s. And even more so when I finished playing football and the internet online betting came in. And obviously then there was more to bet on, although I still only bet on horses, etc. really.
And Steph, when did you first realise that Peter had a problem with gambling?
Quite early on, to be fair, because I noticed he kept going out of my home on his mobile phone a lot, and he was sort of taking a lot of private calls. So I became quite suspicious. And then one day I sort of asked if I could borrow his phone. I wrote a regular number that obviously he'd been ringing up on his phone. And I rang that secretly, and it was a betting company. But then it did take me several years. It was a bit of a silent game of cat and mouse. So fairly early on, but I didn't know the extent of the problem till further on.
And we've obviously heard a lot about in the UK, Paul Merson's gambling addiction. Peter, and Steph, I mean, how common is gambling addiction in football as far as you know?
I think it's very, very rife really in football. Football lends itself, to gambling, because players, you know, when they're playing football, they have a lot of spare time and they're resting. They have to rest in between games, sometimes two, maybe three a week. So that in between time, you know, it's easy just to put your feet up and gamble to keep yourself on a bit of a high, because once you've played the game, you're on a high, then you come down and you build yourself up again. It's a continuous circle. And I think it's the way I used to think, oh, you know, it's a bit of a hobby and you're sort of relaxing and releasing tension. But I soon knew that, you know, I was losing heavily. And, but then it became a way of life. You know, I was earning good money, and obviously I spent money on other things, but, you know, I was losing a lot of money.
And Steph, I gather that you're both now helping other people with gambling and other addictions as well, I think. How, you know, what are you doing to help people?
Gambling advertising on football shirts, because we feel it's a bit of a practical way to start grooming children into normalising football, which is something me and Peter are really anti. We're not anti-gambling. You know, a lot of people enjoy a healthy bet, and, you know, have a great day at the races, enjoy a bet on a football match. But what we're saying is there needs to be better protection and there needs to be better awareness of the extent of the gambling addiction, because it's a huge problem. It's affecting hundreds of thousands in the UK.
It's a very silent addiction. You know, you, addicts don't like, you like to keep it silent, you know, secretive, and you keep it from people around you. And of course, you know, it's only just coming out now, the extent of the addiction now with, you know, suicides, children, more children getting involved, especially with having, you know, a casino in their pocket with their phones.
And Peter, you obviously had an amazing career, more than 1,000 club games, well over 100 appearances for England. You were awarded the OBE. And of course, I'm sure you're expecting this question, you're remembered for the World Cup in 1986, that game against Argentina, Diego Maradona's hand of God goal. How do you feel about that game and that goal now, all these years later?
Well, I like to think after 30 years as a professional, I remember for a lot of things. And certainly after that incident, my career went on a long time, you know, with the World Cup in 1990 and getting to the semi-finals. So, you know, to me, that was just, I was part of an incident that became famous for all the wrong reasons. And, you know, it's been talked about a lot, you know, but obviously I blame Maradona, the referee and linesman, you know, not seeing the incident, not disallowing the goal. And, you know, I've always said that, you know, I thought that Maradona should have admitted and apologised fairly quickly after the game. And that was what I said. And, you know, I stuck by that and always said he was the greatest player I played against. But, you know, it was one of those incidents that really cost us the match, and the referee and linesman didn't do their jobs. I mean, we would have loved to have had VAR in that particular incident. But no, my career carried on after that, and I had a lot of other highs as well.
And Peter, I'm really interested to know how much you were gambling at that time, because it's, you know, this gambling addiction you've had has gone back 45 years. For example, did you have a bet before that game, after that game, both that game against Argentina?
No. I mean, I never let betting interfere with my gambling, you know, with my football, sorry. You know, I just, you know, if I stayed behind after for extra training, I'd do that. You know, it was something that I did, you know, when I'd finished football and I was relaxing around. And certainly when I went on tours with England, you know, I never bothered about betting. I was there to do a job, and I could, that's one thing I could do. I could sort of, you know, do one and then do the other and not interlink them.
We've been working so closely with addicts and loved ones. I have found that a lot of professionals that are gambling addicts do exceptional jobs, because money is a drug. So it's like heroin to a drug user. Money is what feeds the addiction for gambling addiction. So they are going to do perfect jobs, and they're going to try and excel, because at the end of the day, that, you know, the money, they need that's their drug, that's their alcohol.
As a former professional, obviously, Peter, not at your level, and believe me, I'm actually honoured right now to speak to you and your beautiful wife here from South Africa, because my dad was probably one of your biggest fans, and probably most of my family were. And, you know, from a plain side of things, you know, in the 70s and 80s, you know, the alcohol culture of drinking with footballers was on a different level to obviously where it is now. So it seems to be like the gambling phenomena has come over of, you know, like Paul Merson, yourself, you know, who have accepted, you know, the monies that you've lost, and are trying to now pass on the message about, you know, the badness of gambling, because it's so easy and so acceptable now.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Dylan. I mean, the reason, just to put it straight, that I just with Steph decided to write the book was that, you know, we found that we spoke to a lot of people who had lost lost loved ones who committed suicide, and there's 650 a year now committing suicide. And a lot of them say it's because, you know, they didn't think they could quit gambling, you know. And I wanted, I thought being high profile, I could put a message across that, yeah, it took me a long time to learn the lesson, but I did quit just over five years when we wrote the book. It's 6.5 now. And I wanted to say to people, look, you can quit. You know, you don't have to keep gambling. There is a way. And that's why we wrote the book. And, you know, we wrote the book in a sense that we wanted people to enjoy a good read. There's a love story. There's obviously the gambling side of it and you know, good advice, et cetera. But there's a good football section, as we touched on, and advice at the end of the book. And I've been very lucky that some very prominent goalkeepers have written about me. And yeah, we think it's a good book, but predominantly it's there to, you know, to say to people, especially footballers, don't fall into the same trap with especially online gambling, because that's even worse than when I was playing.
So, I mean, Steph, to both of you, how hard was it to actually make that decision to do this? You know, because obviously it's a personal thing, and it's obviously something that you did as part of your career and as part of you. But how hard was it for both of you to come to this, you know, decision to write this book?
I think it was really difficult, especially for myself, because I'm more comfortable being behind Pete in the background. I'm a very private lady. And, you know, so I found it really difficult because we both said the book is in our words, you know, so we said we literally physically wrote it. And we said we have to be honest. And it had been 5 years since Pete had quit. And I sort of said to Pete when he quit, just keep going forward. Don't look back. Don't worry about it. This is the new world, the new life. And we never even discussed it. So when we started writing and we wrote our book, Pete read my story and I read his. And it was very difficult because, you know, Pete read some of the pain that he'd put me through, and he found that so difficult. And I was shocked at Pete's story as well. So it was a mixture of emotions. It wasn't easy because we had to relive some very ugly times. But to make the book real and for you all to believe it, we had to be honest.
Yeah, that was the main thing we said. Look, there's no, you know, holding back. You know, I wanted people to know that I was being 100% honest in what I was saying, and they could relate to it, because, you know, addicted gamblers, you know, illness, we call it an illness, and that helped me when Steph said that, because she had a 20-year NHS background, and so she had a lot of experience in that type of thing, and that helped. But, you know, we both had to be very honest. But as you can imagine, you know, it's very unusual for two people to write a book. And I wanted to hit, you know, home to the addicts, you know, the people who are addicted and or ill at the moment. And Steph wanted really to hit around the loved ones, because there's a lot of people around an addict who get affected by it, you know, and that was very important to put Steph's side of it. And how she overcame it.
I heard it's because you wrote the book together because your hands have been battered over 30 odd years as a goalkeeper, that Steph had to write it for you.
No, seriously, we wrote it separately. Look, I shall never forget when we had actually both agreed on it and it was finished. And Pete came in the kitchen to open a bottle of champagne. And I burst out into tears and I said, oh my God, we're such an amazing couple. Did we really go through that?
Yeah.
Didn't we?
It took a year. It took a year. Wow. And, yeah, it was.
Did we live that life?
Yeah.
You know, how did we manage that?
Yeah.
You know, on our own to overcome it and come through it.
Yeah. So, we're very pleased with the honesty and very pleased with the story, because it does interlink from how gambling was when I started gambling, which was in the sort of 70s, sort of mostly 80s and 90s, and how it's changed, you know, and how online gambling now is absolutely amazingly toxic. And of course, you know, the advertising, our one is the shirt advertising, which is a back way to getting youngsters involved in it. and glamorise it. And football has a responsibility, you know, to you know, clean their act up. I think it's getting to a point where clubs are just grabbing every penny they can because it's easy money, and I don't think it's the right thing for football to go to promoting gambling companies because they're ruthless, absolutely ruthless, and we've learned that.
I want to play devil's advocate because this is a true story, because I actually presented the check. I used to work in Kenya. I used to coach for a team called Gor Mahia. And in Kenya, they were the biggest, all the betting companies are there on the football shows. And it used to be a company called Sport Pacer that sponsored Everton a couple of seasons ago. Now, they had this online betting where you could pick 17 football teams to win. And it accumulated. So if you didn't win, it was a carryover. It was like the lottery. And this one guy lived in a wooden box, basically, with a tin roof, which was held on by bricks, right? I was there, presented him his cheque at his house. He had 16 results coming into the final game, which was Brighton versus Burnley. He won $26 million. That was 290 million shilling that he won. You know, so it's changed this guy's life. I don't even know if he's still alive. But I'm just asking that question because I was there. I actually presented the check because he was a big fan of my team. Yeah. And they asked me to present this check to him.
Yeah, well, Dylan, the bookmakers' profits going up and up and up year in, year out.
Agreed.
You know, so
agreed.
For every one person who has a very lucky win, you know, whether it's doing the lottery or doing something like that, you know, there's millions that lose regularly and put money into gambling, you know. So, yes, and you always read in papers when a fella's had 10p on and won, you know, 30 or 50 grand or something with against the odds, but you never read, or you do read now, people who have lost, you know, families have lost everything. So for everyone, you know, every person that does have a big win, there's millions who don't.
Anyone that's winning or any football team that's receiving any money from gambling companies, 50% of the profit a gambling company gets comes from 5% of addicts. So that 60% of those millions that gentleman won would have come from addicts, people that have lost homes, people that might have lost lives, people that were in prisons.
Yeah.
Dylan, we're not against gambling. You know, what we're against is that the betting companies, you know, need to be reined in, and their practices, their safeguards. There's no affordability checks or anything, and as well as everything else we've talked about, you know, they're ruthless, and we've had it firsthand, and we've, you know, so many people have written to us, you know, with the same stories of how they've just ripped them off and everything else. And, you know, that side has got to be told. You know, yes, there is the odd, you know, big win. But as we've discussed, you know, it's very few and far between.
What you've done is identify and try and tell people about the weaknesses and the problems that it could do. And only last week on Twitter, this lady posted a picture of her husband who'd killed himself because he was on furlough. He got an app on his phone to do online betting for free that got him hooked into doing it. And the girl's 29, he's 30, and he killed himself over it because he got into so much debt.
Yeah.
And so I think what you're doing, what the pair of you are doing is absolutely phenomenal. And I hope a lot of people get the book. I hope people read it and listen and learn to what you're saying, because it's important. I think it's very important.
Yeah. It's like any addiction, Dylan. You know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of people who say, well, I don't I only have a pint. I don't drink a lot. For people who become alcoholics, you know, there's a lot of people who can, like we say, have a bet every now and again and keep it within means. And we're not against that, you know, but you know, it's an ever increasing under the surface addiction now or illness that is affecting more and more people, especially, as we say, with online gambling.
By the time we go to bed tonight, there'll be 2 suicides in the UK. This is serious. It's serious stuff. And there's no safeguarding. There's no safeguarding.
No.
Yeah. So finally, Steph and Peter, the book's called Saved, Overcoming a 45-Year Gambling Addiction. How can our listeners get hold of a copy of the book?
Well, I think, you know, online it's W.H. Smith, Waterstones, Amazon. There's loads. There's probably about.
If you just Google Peter Shilton Saved, there's loads of places for them. Yeah, it sold out by the buyers in 5 days of its release. And the great thing is actually, Dylan, I was going to say to you earlier, you know, when you touched on about footballers being dragged into what we've very cleverly done, and a lot of women have gone out and brought Save for Christmas presents because they suspect their other half is gambling. So they think that they're buying a biography by Peter Shilton. It's a football book. But the great thing is there's hidden messages and support within it. So it's clever.
We hope it helps a lot of people who've probably not come out yet, as regards admitting that they've got an illness with gambling. And the first step is to admit it and get some help. And we've talked about that in the book and a lot of other things.
We had one message come through on here, our company. We've had hundreds of messages, but we did an interview with them this morning. And as I came out, I had a message come through from this 31-year-old guy, and he was going to commit suicide that morning, and the telly was on, and he listened to our interview, and he went back home to his parents the following morning. That's what this is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, that's brilliant. Amazing. That's amazing. No, really echo what Dylan said. You know, it's not just a book, is it? It's not just an autobiography. There's got some really strong messages in there. And you've already demonstrated that you're helping people. Before I let you both go, if it's okay, Peter, we've got the World Cup coming up next year. The last two tournaments for England, semi-finals, final. Can we go one better next year, do you think?
I think we can. There's a lot of exciting young players coming through, you know, like Foden and Bellingham and players that can only get better, you know, as well as people like Grealish, who's going to benefit from working at Man City, you know, under Pep. And I think we can get stronger than what we have been in the Euros. And it's a gradual progress. You know, we had a little bit of a hiccup against Hungary, but you're bound to have the odd game when things are not 100% right. You've got to learn from that. But I really feel we can go there with a lot of confidence and a very strong squad and have a chance of winning it. I do. And I haven't said that for any World Cups in recent years.
Well, thank you for myself and Dylan. Thank you both of you for being with us. That's been fantastic. And, you know, hearing your story and, you know, the messages that you're getting out there and how you're helping other people. So thank you very much.
No, pleasure. Nice to speak to you, Mark. Peter, nice to speak to you, Dylan.
I'm honoured. And I've just got one message for you. I was in the pub on Saturday. We was watching the football and I was talking to some Cockney guy. You know, I've only met him a couple of times. And I was telling him that I was going to speak to you. And he says his granddad used to coach you when you were a youth player, and his name is Bob Arundel. And I says, Peter's never going to remember that. He'll never remember that. But apparently, as a young boy, he said, as he said that some guy, his granddad called Bob Arundel, used to coach Peter. And I thought, that just typifies your name. Your name is still. Still looked at as you know, the best England goalkeeper. Sorry, but yeah, You know, no disrespect to Ray Clements and Peter Benetti and David Seaman, but, you know, and thank you
Don't
for
forget Gordon Banks. Gordon was a pretty decent keeper as well. No, he was brilliant.
He made one save, Peter. He made one save. I think you made three more than him. So I'll give it to you. I grew up watching you.
Thanks, Dylan. I really appreciate that.
Stay well, stay safe, and keep the message going, please.
Thank you.
Well, Mark, you can let everybody know if there's gambling addicts out there with loved ones, tell them to reach out, get help, reach out.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you, Steph. Thank you, Peter. Great to meet you both.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
Now I'd like to welcome Stephen Constantine to the show. Thanks for joining us, Stephen. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me. Great to see Dylan as well. Looking forward to the show.
And Stephen, I just wanted to start by asking you about your career in many countries, and as well as playing in the USA, and you've coached in England. You've also managed national teams in Nepal, India, Malawi, Sudan, and Rwanda. So I wanted to start by asking you about the cultural differences that you've experienced, and perhaps also the different attitudes to football in all of those different countries.
I understood very, very early on in my career that going into someone else's country, I am the one who had to change to adapt to how they are. Now, you could say, oh, yeah, easier said than done, and Dylan will know this. It is easier said than done. You just have to put the I'm English or Scottish or whatever you are aside and think, well, they want me because I have some abilities that they feel they can help them. I need to find a way to do that. Okay, so all around you, there may be absolute chaos. It may be we don't do things like that here. That's not how things are done. But you cannot go in with the attitude, well, in England, this is how we do it, or in Germany, this is how we do it. Therefore, this is how we're going to play. You've got to find the good things that they have, and there are some if you look hard enough. And of course, you'll obviously see the bad things pretty quickly and try to change how you teach. We teach football. We're not rocket scientists. We don't save lives. We teach people how to play this game. And that's all it is, nothing more. So you've got to find a way as a teacher to educate your students. And I think the reason that myself, I keep mentioning Dylan because he sat there in front of me, is we found those ways to do that, you know? So it's not about me changing their culture. It's me adapting to their culture, but changing their habits. We're talking football habits.
I'll agree with you, Steve, because, you know, you have to become, you can't come up and say, right, I used to play for Leeds, I used to play for Arsenal, I used to play for Chelsea, and this is how we do it. You know, you have to adapt. I'm coming over to coach a team in Kenya, Gor Mahia, or I'm in Vietnam with Haiphong. You have to become Vietnamese. You have to become South African. You can always speak about what you've done in football and how things are done in Europe, but the mentality of Asian football, African football to European football is a lot different. And I agree with you 100% there, Steve.
Yeah.
And also, Stephen, can I ask you, and Dylan's experienced something similar as well. So what would be some of the key differences from your experience of managing the national teams in Nepal and India, for example, to, you know, be a manager of Rwanda, Malawi and Sudan?
You know, the one common trait with the Asian players and the African players is they want to learn. Okay, I found that if you have the ability to teach, and teaching comes in many different guises, but if you have that, you will find a way, and you will see that there won't be too many other countries or continents that work harder than those two. And I think that's very, very important when you have players who want to learn. Okay, so in England or in Europe, shall we say, maybe in the States, South America, by the time the kid is 20 years old, he's had 10 coaches. And I bet you any money you like that nine of those coaches have been telling him for the last 10 years, don't do this, don't do that. This is not right. That's not right. As opposed to, well, do you think that you can adjust? Should you be doing this? Or should be... So by the time they're 20, we've coached the life out of these kids. And that's, we absolutely throttle the creativity in them. We don't let them think for themselves, because there's the development coach telling him, there's the under 19 coach telling him, the under 17 coach. I recently went, 2 years now. I was in England and I went to see some teams, Premier League sides train. I saw the under 23s teams play. What's the league called in England now? It's the youth league, whatever, for under 23s. And I tell you, I was watching one game, two Premier League sides. I almost fell asleep. I was like, get it, pass back to the goalkeeper. Goalkeeper passes to the left back passes to the stopper. Stopper passes to the left midfield. The left midfield, without even looking, passes it back to the left back. And then they go around and around and around and around. And I'm like, wow, if this is football, where's passing the ball forward? Where's going forward with the ball when you have the opportunity? It was really sad to see. And then you see the two coaches on the sideline screaming and shouting. And when they're winning, they're screaming and shouting. When they're not losing, it's you know, I don't understand. I think the game has changed. And I can't say for the better. Not at that level.
Don't you agree, though? I mean, like, look, we've had the luxury of working abroad, and I've spoken to it in previous shows. I would swim back England if somebody gave me the opportunity to get in football, but I can't see that happening because I don't seem to look at my resume, which has not got one blemish on it, which has got nine championships, two cup winners, and three status that I've kept in South Africa. They don't recognise, you know, that what we have to do here is far bigger and far greater than what coaches in England or Scotland do, because it's all there for them. It's all there for them.
I must say, I completely understand you, and I look at my CV and I think it's not bad. I've not been a manager and been relegated. I've won a couple of promotions in European leagues. I have gone to the Asian Cup final. I don't know too many other British coaches that have done that with a squad that the average age was 23. But they don't appreciate, yeah, but you haven't done it in England. I mean, in the summer, I was offered a job in the National League. Okay, he said to me, I'll give you the keys to the building. And I didn't, because it wasn't right. And I said to him, you know, you've already appointed this guy, that guy, this guy, that guy. So I can't bring my people. So that's one reason. I said, but, you know, there needs to be a vision for me. And there wasn't, as far as I could see. And like I said, we're only going to get one chance, and it won't be a chance. It'll be eight games, because the crowd will be going mental. Oh, who is this guy? What does he know about League Two? Or what does he know about League? You play on a grass pitch, 11v11. And the reason that you called me is because I can change how your players are playing. I'm not going to change the culture. I'm not going to change the thing, but I can get players to play for me. My experience of being all over the world, or in most places, at any given Saturday in any change room in the UK now, you've got between 8 and 12 nationalities. Okay. In Paphos, the last game we had, I had, I think, 16 different nationalities in the change room. You know, if you can deal with those kinds of situations, then, you know, it's just about somebody believing you, giving you the support. And then you'll show them what you can do, and they'll be really pleased that they hired you.
Well, I'm actually, like, right now, we can't see live games at the moment, Stephen. So,
are you in South Africa?
I'm still in South Africa, so I'm not working at the moment, because my last club you know, decided that they were going to insult me by giving me very, very poor offer. And basically, they found it difficult to go in a direction that I wanted to take the club. But every time I like watching live football games, and there's nothing better than going to a stadium, whether it's full, whether it's empty, and watching a live game, whether I'm a coach, whether I'm just a fan. And it's very, very, I'm told by the Football League, the Premier League, sorry, and other coaches that you can't come to these games because it's perceived that you want the job, you know, and that's not the intention. You know, I just like going to watch football, you know, because it's good for me, for my education, because I'm still learning.
Are you telling me that the FA or the Premier League in South Africa will not allow you to attend a live game because you might want the job? That's
obviously for COVID, you know, the PSL is for COVID, but there is a way to go and watch, but then you get told by all the other teams, don't come. And to be fair, they're right, because the pressure then comes on you because they see you're there, not to watch the game, but they see you're there to get the job. And that's not my intention, whatever. You know, I wouldn't do that anyway. I just like watching live football.
Look, I'm not sure I agree 100%, Dylan, because unfortunately, that is the nature of the job. How are you going to understand about you're looking for a job? So you're going to go and watch. So I went to a job the other job. I went to a game the other day here between a first division and a second division team. There are rumors that the guy in the first division that they want to get rid of him, but he's doing okay. Am I not going to go? I'm going to go. I'm going to go and watch the team. I'm going to have my own opinion. Of course, I'm going to keep my mouth shut and not. You're not going to go and say, I'm here if he gets sacked the job. But you still have to be up to date. And as you say, watching a game live is very different to watching a game on TV. You also have to be seen. So you could be at that game and nobody's going to be fired because you're at the game. They're going to be fired because the other guys had a nightmare. And by the way, somebody else has seen you at the game. Oh, look, Dylan Kerr, he's keeping tabs on things. It's the professional thing to do. And I wouldn't take it that you are not doing anything to affect that game for that guy to lose his job.
Thank you, Stephen, for joining us, and great to have you on as a guest. And now it's time for our weekly look at women's football. And unfortunately, Cheryl can't be with us this week. It's fair to say she had a bit of an ordeal on Sunday as Portsmouth women's game at London Bees was off due to a waterlogged pitch. But all the players, Cheryl included, had gone to the game on the coach. And then unfortunately, the player's coach got stuck in heavy traffic on her way back from the game. So as we've recorded this on Sunday evening, unfortunately, Cheryl didn't make it. So look forward to speaking to you next week, Cheryl. And you've left it to me to update our listeners on what happened in the Women's FA Cup semi-finals on Sunday. So first, there was a 3-0 win for Chelsea against the FA Cup holders, Manchester City. And then no surprises in Sunday's second game with a comfortable win for Arsenal against Brighton, although all the goals came in the second half. So it's Chelsea against Arsenal in the FA Cup final. And it's also looking like Chelsea against Arsenal for the WSL title, of course, the way the results have gone so far. And now we're joined by Fulham FC Women's head coach, Steve Jay. And Steve, welcome to the show. Firstly, for anyone listening who doesn't know, could you tell us a little bit about Fulham FC Women and where they sit in the women's football pyramid?
Yeah, of course. And thanks for the invite, Mark. Really appreciate coming on. So yeah, so Fulham FC Women currently sit in Tier 5 in the national pyramid. We sort of restarted as a club back in sort of 2013. I'm sure people that have been following women's football for a long time will know that we had a really successful professional side in the early 2000s, and unfortunately that team stopped. So we restarted the team in 2013 and have sort of been on a progressive journey since then to rebuild a really respectable women's team programme. So the last sort of 3 or 4 years, we've been really supported by the men's football club. And this season has seen probably the most drastic sort of changes in bringing the women's team alongside the performance side of the football club. And so rather than sitting in other departments, which is what's happened in previous seasons, we now sit directly into the performance side, which has been fantastic for us.
And can you sort of explain a bit more about how that works? So you've got the support from the club itself. How do you benefit from what's happening with the men's club, the men's?
I think the biggest thing for us is that we want to make sure that the experiences for the players are where they should be for the level that we play at, but also above that. So it's not about us saying that we're going to be a championship or a WSL side in the shortest possible time and therefore investing the vast amount of money to support potentially that happening in the next 2 to 3 seasons, 4 seasons. It's about us making sure that we progressively take steps to ensure that the experiences the players have and the staff have allow us to build to that point sustainably. And also just, for example, just ensuring that players get what they should get at this level when they give up so much of their time. So the support that we see, the players definitely see, are around things like the training facilities and the match day facilities. So we're based at the training ground where the men's team train for 2 training sessions a week. And then our matches are hosted on the stadium pitch that we have at the training ground. And then there's lots of other things around sort of staff infrastructure. So we've got a good staff team that looks after all the aspects that you'd expect a football staff team to look after. So we have a sports scientist, we have a goalkeeper coach, we have a physio with us at all games and all training sessions. We have an analyst, etc. All the things that are expected are sort of supported and invested by the club. And then there's little things like the players don't pay to play for us. And we're not in a position where we pay any of the players anything to come and play for us. We appreciate that they give up a lot of time, but they get a lot of sort of support in return. But none of the players pay to play at this level, which I think is really important. But they're also supported from an insurance perspective as well. And so the club have invested in medical insurance for the team, which is, again, an expensive business. And so to know that the players are supported in that way is really key. And like I say, it all comes back down to the experiences that they get. It's not about us saying in the next 3 seasons, I mean, this could happen. It'd be great if it did, but that's not necessarily the way that we would like to do it in terms of investing heavily in players for them to potentially not be here for the next couple of years after that point. It's about us investing in the experiences and the journey that we sort of go on. Yeah.
And you mentioned there about players. How important is it for you to bring young players through?
Yeah, it's a really big part of what we're trying to work towards. We've got a great sort of connection with our foundation, so the charity arm of the football club that hosts a variety of youth programs. We are looking to try and expand on that and improve that, obviously, with the other clubs that we compete with in the area with their RTCs, etc. We're not at that stage just yet, but that is certainly something we're working towards. But we've got a great connection, like I say, with our GDC, our Girls Development Centre, which is run by the foundation. We've actually, today's call is really timely, had one of the players who finished her under 16 season last season with the GDC. She has moved into our senior team and she started her first game today and scored on her debut, which is also her birthday. It's really important for us to bring youth team players through. We're just trying to work on the structure to make sure that we've got the appropriate pathways. But yeah, it's super key.
And in case people are wondering, if you play on Tuesdays, we're actually recording this on Sunday. So
yeah.
happy birthday. But I just wondered also about your journey. How did you, how did you come to be in the role of Fulham FC women head coach?
Yeah, I mean, well, I've been really fortunate that I've had a number of experiences within women's football and girls football since I started coaching back in 2006 now. So I've been coaching for a little while. Like I said before, the program used to be ran by the foundation, used to be ran by the charity arm of the football club. And one of my roles there was to oversee a number of programs, but one of them was the women's team. And we just had a few changes of staff, and the opportunity came up to take the team for a little while. And I really enjoyed taking the team for that short period of time. And so, yeah, we decided to sort of see that through to the end of the season. And then, this is my fourth season. So 3 years later, I'm still in the position here. But I love working with the group, and yeah, it's been a great journey so far.
And you've already talked about some of the aims that you've got for Fulham FC Women in terms of the development and where you hope to go in the near future. What about you personally? What are your aims?
Yeah, it's a good question. Puts me on the spot a little bit. No, I think for me, the journey that the club are going on here is it's an exciting project and an exciting journey that we're starting. And I've been part of this now for three seasons already. I mean, in terms of coaching, I guess nobody really knows where their journeys can take them. And I'm sure there's a lot of, I certainly know there's a lot of quality coaches in the tiers above. But I think everybody's aspiration is to try and see what is their competitive level, what level can you reach and achieve. And so, yeah, of course, I'll keep pushing until I reach that ceiling, whatever that looks like. But I'm certainly hopeful that we can achieve that at this club, because, like I say, the project and the journey that we're sort of developing is, it's special to be part of at the moment.
Well, I wish you well with that, Steve, and thanks ever so much for joining us. Been great to have you on as a guest. And that's it for this week's look at women's football. But you can join us again next week when our guest will be Eastleigh Ladies assistant coach Brad Walsh. And now it's time for
football fans from around the world.
And this week we have Pete Redding, who's a Newcastle United fan in Dubai. And Pete, tell us, why did you start supporting Newcastle?
I was born in Newcastle, born and bred. A good goal kick away from St James's Park. And I always remember as a youngster, my dad disappearing every Saturday afternoon to this thing called The Match. Never knew really what he was doing. He had his big John Motson sheepskin coat on, and out he went on a Saturday winter's afternoon. And then six or seven, it was my turn. So I had no choice in the matter, really. I was taken over to St James's Park, and I'd like to say the love affair started there. Lots of years of heartache. But yeah, I was born and bred there, and my dad took me to my first game.
Talk about your best memory as a Newcastle fan.
Oh, wow. Look, there's been some great ones. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be at an age of a young man sort of going out when the entertainers were on. So everyone's favourite second team, you could pick any of those games. I think that season where they lost it to Manchester United, they say lost, but Manchester United did go on a 20-21 game unbeaten run, to be fair to them. I think that was just the best time of life. If you think about it, the music was out, which was great. We were listening to Oasis, Blur. The cities were all, you know, we had Euro 96. So football was great in general. I went to every game home and away and watched a fabulous Newcastle team. You could take your pick from Ginola, Les Ferdinand, Andy Cole. I think they were all great memories. Greatest memory would probably be the night of Barcelona watching Faustino Asprilla destroy them. That in itself as a single memory was absolutely fantastic, very special. And a certain Keith Gillespie as well, who has to be mentioned, literally put everything on a dinner plate for Tino that night. It was a great night, great atmosphere.
And who's your favourite Newcastle player of all time?
It's a funny one, because he's twice at Newcastle, and everyone thinks, you know, people are going to say it's going to be Shearer, but it's not. It's Peter Beardsley. I think that when you look at Beardsley, he got us promoted in 84. He was playing alongside Keegan then, and Beardsley and Chris Waddle at the time, which was a fantastic achievement. And he was magic then. And he went on to Liverpool and all of those international as well, Everton. But when he came back, he was equally good, as if not better. He basically cemented the promotion again and our rise. And people talk about Andy Cole being such a great goal scorer. You know, out of those 84 goals, I'd love to know how many assists were Beardsley. I'd say 90% were. So it's got to be Peter Beardsley for me.
And finally, Pete, where do you think Newcastle will finish this season? That's the million-dollar question.
You know, it's exciting times, first and foremost, that this new ownership. So I think the first thing to look at is survival. And the way they're going to do that is by injecting new hope into the team and the fans with a great addition, hopefully, with the management. I mean, there's talk of directors of football, but, you know, they need a good coach, someone who are going to stimulate the side, get them going, because they've got to pull out. They've got to pull out of where they are, their second bottom. And I had a giggle with my friends the other day and said it would be the most NUFC thing ever to become the richest club in the world and be playing in the Championship. No disrespect to the teams that are in there. So it's pivotal that the new regime get this right, because there's a lot to play for. It's not a mid-table team there. Newcastle are struggling and they need results.
And now we're joined by Harley Taylor, who's 14 years old and he's a Southampton fan from Gosport in Hampshire. So Harley, welcome to the Early Doors Football Podcast. Can you start by telling us when and why did you start supporting Southampton?
It was pretty much just when I was born. I didn't actually like football till I was like seven. So, my dad just wanted me to play football, and that's when I started supporting Southampton. He took me to my first game, and that's when I just loved the club.
Because that's a local team for you, isn't it? Obviously, in living in Gosport. And in the 7 years so far as a Southampton fan, what's your best memory?
Probably the Shane Long goal against Liverpool in 2017, last minute. I just remember celebrating so much.
And you've obviously mentioned Shane Long there. But who's been your favourite player in all the time you supported Southampton?
Shane Long, just for the couple of moments he's had at Southampton, and Ward-Prowse also.
And then finally, where do you think Southampton will finish this season? What sort of, how do you think they'll get on the rest of the season?
I think if we have a good window in January, I reckon we could finish higher, but I reckon we'll finish 14th around there.
So do you think that will be a good season for you, just to stay in the Premier League?
Yeah, for now, while we rebuild, it'll be important for us to do that and rebuild.
All right, Harley. Well, great to get you on, and thanks for being on the show, and hopefully get you back on later in the season to see how things are going.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Harley. And I'm joined by Paul Geeden, who's a West Ham fan in Auckland in New Zealand. Hello, Paul. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Mark. Glad to be on.
Yeah, great to have you. And Paul, as I always do, want to start by asking you why you started supporting West Ham.
So I'm originally from the East End, and it's a bit of a family thing. And when you grow up in the East End, you don't have a lot of choice. There are the few brave ones, but not many.
And, you know, how long have you been a West Ham fan? And in all that time, what's your best memory of supporting the club?
So it's 51 years, man and boy now. Started going as a teenager with friends from school. So we were going during the Cotty McAvenny years, and they were wonderful times, great football. And I think we're only just seeing that type of football again now. But I think my best memory was watching Di Canio play, and I was there that day, that goal. Unfortunately, I was at the other end, but actually that was probably a good view, because we were behind the goal at the other end. And when Sinclair put that ball over, we were all just looking for who was backing up, because he was going to lay it off, obviously. And then when he put that ball in, it was pandemonium, just absolute pandemonium.
And it's one of those goals that keeps getting played over and over again, isn't it? And yeah, quite rightly so as well. So,
we can't ever get together here in New Zealand without watching the goal.
Yeah, there you go. So you mentioned Di Canio. Who's your favourite West Ham player in all that time?
Yeah, I think for all that time, I've seen some really good players. You know, the Coty-McAvaney partnership. I think that's the best partnership I've ever seen. I think we're just starting to see that now with Souček and Rice. If they can sort the little problem they've got out at the moment, that might come back to being a fantastic partnership. Individuals, Di Canio, Payet, even though his name's mud for us now. But I think the one player that's really stood out for me for all those years, and when they write the history books at the end of this season, Mr. West Ham, Mark Noble's going to be my favourite player probably forever.
And on that note, where do you think they'll finish this season?
Oh, tough one. I think it's going to be a more difficult season for us. I think trying as hard as we are to go deep into the Cups, to go deep into the Europa League, and continue the good form in the league. I think seventh would be a really good result this year, maybe eighth. I think we'll be in and around that kind of area.
All right, Paul, well, maybe as we often say, maybe we'll get you back on at the end of the season and see if you were right.
I certainly hope so.
All right, Paul, well, great to speak to you from the other side of the world. And yeah, thanks for coming on.
Awesome. Thank you, Mark.
Early Doors Football Podcast for football fans worldwide. If you want to get in touch with Mark and the rest of the team, you can reach them on earlydoors@forthenow.co.uk.